Welcome back to Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena. I'm Jack Llewellyn, and thank you as always for joining me. Let's hop right into the topic for the day. Since I've been doing this podcast for about a year and a half now, and in light of my work around the Camarena case and my book that talked a lot about the Camarena case, and then the current book that will be out soon that talks a lot about the fentanyl crisis, I tend to get one group of questions as much or more than any other, with the possible exception of, okay, who do you really think killed Agent Camarena? The question I get a lot is, all right, the drug trafficking problem, the fentanyl trafficking problem, the problem with the cartels, everyone seems to acknowledge it's a huge problem. Does it get any better? How can we make it better? Or alternatively, if it's not going to get better, why not? And I usually end up talking about two points, one of which I get a lot of grief for online and some social media sectors, because I think we have to look at the demand in the United States and in other places. And though it might be a bit of a chicken and the egg, demand to some point fuels the supply. And if the demand doesn't decrease, the supply is unlikely to decrease no matter how hard we try, because, as I've said many times before, if you plug the hole in one place, they'll find another way. Somebody will take up the slack, so to speak. So that's issue number one. And as I say, I get a little bit of grief over that, which is fine. The second thing I talk about quite frequently is Mexican economics. And by that, I mean this. There are many places in Mexico where economic opportunity, especially for the younger generation, is limited at best. And so if you are in those areas and within those demographics, or you know, you have a family to feed and you're in one of those areas and you see few economic prospects, working for the cartels may be a way to see some economic opportunity for yourself and for your family. It may be a way to feed your kids, frankly. And as long as there is that class of people who are economically deprived with very little economic outlook, very little opportunity on the horizon, they will be primed to continue working for the cartels and continuing to resupply the cartels if and as they lose members. So those are the two things that I've talked about. And obviously I know first that even the couple of issues I've talked about are much broader, things that we would want to talk about in depth. So that those were shorthand answers. I also know that there are many other factors. And as I get pointed out to me every once in a while, I'm just a lawyer. You know, I haven't been on the ground fighting cartels, fighting drugs, though I talk to several people on a regular basis who have. This last week, I read two articles that we're going to talk about today that take my answers and expand on them in slightly different ways. So one is an article that is essentially directed to the major presidential candidates. And as we'll discuss, it basically says, you know, here's the things that you need to be thinking about as you're thinking about or developing a plan related to the fentanyl crisis, to drug trafficking, to the borders. And then the second is an article talking about a hidden issue within Mexico's government and governmental infrastructure that I think is fascinating and may make the ability to combat the cartels, whether in the United States or in Mexico or in conjunction, more difficult. And we'll explain what that issue is when we get there. Okay, so the first article is titled Combating the Fentanyl Crisis, a Strategy for the 2024 White House Aspirants. It was published on the website defenseopinion.com, and it is written by Michael W. Brown, who had a 32-year career as a special agent in the DEA. Most recently, he was the DEA headquarters staff coordinator for the Office of Foreign Operations for the Middle East, Europe, Afghanistan, and India. He is the global director for counter-narcotics technology at the Ragaku Analytical Devices. I have read a lot of online texts, messages, articles from Mr. Brown. I've disagreed with him on, you know, openly a couple of different times, at least one of which I didn't get the response I was hoping for. But he's got an extensive background. He has a very distinct opinion. And again, as I said earlier, he has a 32-year career in the DEA. So between the two of us, we have 32 years in law enforcement. Maybe someday I'll be able to have him on this podcast and we can discuss some of our differences of opinions. But I think his article is extremely interesting, and I want to go through it with you. So the first thing Mr. Brown starts off with is talking about the fentanyl crisis itself. And we all know that it is, in fact, a crisis of truly epic proportions. But here's what he says, and all of these have citations too, so I'm not disputing the facts that he's presenting even a little bit. He says there were over 112,000 fentanyl overdose deaths in 2023, which amounts to 2,153 Americans on average per week. And the narcotic is the leading cause of death in the 18 to 45 year age group. The DEA recently noted that in 2023, it seized in excess of 77 million fentanyl pills and nearly 12,000 pounds of fentanyl powder. That amounts to more than 386 million deadly doses of fentanyl, enough to kill every American. The other question I get asked a lot is, how in the world can those numbers be the way they are? I mean, that's just a staggering amount of fentanyl. And I'll note, the DEA in the last week or so has said that Q1 of 2024 resulted in more seizures than any other quarter in history. So the idea that the fentanyl crisis truly is a crisis of epic proportions is undisputed. So Mr. Brown says there are a couple of areas that White House aspirants, which I think at this point means former President Trump, President Biden, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He says there's a couple of areas that people need to focus on, or these people need to focus on. One is he talks about foreign policy changes. And he says diplomatic efforts to disable the fentanyl supply chain have to date failed. In 2018 and 2019, negotiations managed to persuade the Chinese authorities to pass laws prohibiting the export of fentanyl and some precursor chemicals. Unfortunately, little effort was made on enforcement. And then he says, the presidential nominees must address the importance of concluding and enforcing effective bilateral agreements with China and Mexico as a starting point, not just China, in which all parties work together to destroy the cartels and their suppliers' capabilities and apparent legal immunity. Both China and Mexico must be held accountable. I think many of us would agree with those general sentiments. The obvious question that I have is, it is easy to say we're going to hold China accountable. It's easy to say we're going to hold Mexico accountable. I think it's harder to say in what ways are we going to do that that doesn't hurt American people, American economics, more than it hurts China or Mexico, right? Grand solutions are easy sometimes. It's the implementation, the specifics of how does it work that are more difficult. But in any event, Mr. Brown says we need to start with foreign policy changes that include holding Mexico and China accountable. Then he says the next thing that we need to do is have a strategy that really deals with the cartels. Now, he starts with the premise that most of the fentanyl killing Americans is smuggled through the Mexican border, with the precursors mainly coming from China. As a result, these sources must be targeted economically and legally, making it more complicated and more costly for them to get away with turning a blind eye. I think there's two points that I just want to touch on. One in particular, I think, is the idea that precursors primarily come from China. And that certainly was the case. But if you've read the newsletter recently, you'll see that almost every week there seems to be an article talking about the fact that precursor chemicals are coming from other locations, Indonesia, India, other places such as that. And two, that Mexico and the Mexican cartels are getting better at, more sophisticated at, creating the precursor chemicals themselves and becoming less dependent on China. Now, is that somewhat less dependent? Is a lot less dependent? That continuum, I think, is unknown at this time. But I think it's important to recognize that while the focus on China and Chinese precursors is important, it should not be the be-all and end-all. Mr. Brown goes on to say, the presidential contestants should discuss why more technology-based interventions and inspections are needed to increase the speed and accuracy of narcotic detection, inhibiting the cartels' ability to move precursor chemicals from China to clandestine drug laboratories in Mexico, and degrading their smuggling routes into the U.S. as a first step to impede the cartel's ability to operate. Again, totally agree with the sentiment. I wonder, and maybe some of you who are listening have better information on this than I, but remember we talked a few weeks ago about the supply chain of precursors and how it gets into Mexico and the really sophisticated efforts that the cartels and the suppliers go through to quickly and undercover move precursor chemicals from ships offshore to laboratories in Mexico in very short order, very quickly, very surreptitiously, with very few people in the know as to what's going on. So the idea that we need to disrupt that chain obviously makes sense. Again, I think the devil is in the details. Another issue, and I've tried really hard on this program to avoid talking about immigration directly, focusing more on issues relating to cartels and the drug trafficking as opposed to immigration, whether it be legal or, in air quotes, illegal. But Mr. Brown says There has to be something done. Presidential contenders need to be addressing the southern border issue. He says a robust border is necessary to save lives. Stopping the influx of cartel mules among the many immigrants crossing into the U.S. will require finishing physical border barriers where applicable and ensuring that every person crossing the border illegally is stopped and appropriately screened and processed. It is important to note that the migrants who cross the border and surrender themselves to Customs and Border Protection are not suspected of muling cartel drugs. Additionally, the nominees must explain how upgrading and hardening border checkpoints and secondary checkpoints to better scrutinize motor vehicles and their passengers, trucks, and cargo is non-negotiable. More border guards with enhanced training will create longer queues, but will also capture and deter smugglers. So there's two points there. In principle, totally agree. No argument, right? We'd all love to be better leading up to perfect at the border. We'll never get to perfect, but you know, if almost everything trying to get across the border was caught, that'd be great. I think you have two issues. One is simply cost. And we can debate amongst ourselves what the cost-benefit ratio is. But we've also seen congressional inactivity, congressional inertia, and getting a bill that addresses the border, a bill that provides additional funds for some of the things that Mr. Brown is talking about has proven very difficult. So it's not enough for a presidential aspirant to say, as Mr. Brown says, that upgrading and hardening the border checkpoints and secondary checkpoints is a non-negotiable. A president can say that, but you got to get it through Congress too. So that's number one. The second thing is just this idea of the last line saying we'll create longer queues, but we'll capture and deter smugglers. There again has to be a cost-benefit analysis applied. To what extent would increased scrutiny at the border, especially with respect to commercial traffic, create economic damages to a point where the willingness of the participants and the willingness of the public to allow these longer queues would continue, right? There's a point at which slowing down commercial traffic, even in an effort to capture or, you know, to find drugs, to secure the border, and even if people accept that, there is a point at which the economic impact of an exceedingly long slowdown, at exceeding disruptions of the flow of commerce, will create problems. So where is that balance? I don't know. But I submit that whomever tries to implement new procedures, whether that's at a presidential, executive level, whether that's congressional, or even whether it's state, or sometimes let's talk about just agencies, that balance has to be considered in my mind. The fourth point, or the next point that Mr. Brown talks about, is declaring the cartels narco-terrorists. He says the aspirant presidents must also make the tough decision to declare the cartels as narco-terrorists because their activities directly affect the national security of our country. A narco-terrorism declaration would authorize a whole-of-government approach that would significantly mitigate cartel drug production and operational capabilities in Mexico. Query if that's true. There are folks on the other side of this issue who would say that the declaration of narco-terrorism in and of itself would do very little to mitigate the cartels or the flow of drugs into the United States. He does go on to say, additionally, cartel proxies and their financiers could be charged with aiding and abetting terrorists, a federal offense with long jail sentences. This includes distributing fentanyl, even in small amounts, acting as a mule or go-between for the cartels, as well as direct cartel operations. To me, this sounds a lot like the crack epidemic. And remember, one of the problems that happened was in response to the crack epidemic, there were federal sentencing guidelines imposed. And there became a point where those guidelines appeared to be, or were judged to be by many, as exceedingly harsh and exceedingly unfair to certain demographics in our society, principally those coming from the inner cities. It is possible that even if something such as Mr. Brown is suggesting here is implemented, it would be hard to implement it in a fair and equitable sort of way. All right, the last thing that Mr. Brown talks about is a uniform domestic anti-narcotic strategy. He starts off with two sentences that I think we all can agree with. The critical requirement for any successful policy aimed at stopping the fentanyl crisis is uniformity. Currently, America's approach is fragmented, as some states take a hard line against narcotics crimes, while others have decriminalized the sale of certain narcotics in limited amounts. Then he goes on to say, the candidates must justify and build enough support to create a uniform federal anti-narcotic strategy and ensure states adhere to it. There will be no safe cities or states where cartels can operate with impunity, but they will face the full force of the federal government for fentanyl-related crimes. That, I believe, is or could be problematic. And I note that both sides of the political aisle are in favor of states' rights, except when they're not. They love states' rights unless it's something that, you know, doesn't appeal to them. And I find it hard to believe that there would be a mechanism available that would garner kind of the universal or widespread support that would allow for federal control at every level, right? You know, the idea of saying that you're going to have a uniform federal anti-narcotic strategy and ensure the states adhere to it. And we've all lived through kind of the federal blackmail, whether it's, you know, the speed limit or the drinking age or other things. You know, if you don't do it, you're not going to get federal funds. But when you do that, there can be issues associated with it. And so I wonder if we really are in a position where we'll be able to develop a uniform national strategy on narcotics, and whether, as I think is suggested here, it's a uniform strategy on fentanyl, but not necessarily a uniform strategy on other things. And you know, the genie's out of the bottle with respect to marijuana. The genie's out of the bottle with respect to certain other drugs in other locations. Are we going to be able to put that back in and say, okay, we're going to go back to where everything's uniform? I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's a difficult ask for any president, any Congress to achieve. All right, so those are my comments with respect to Mr. Brown's article here. And I think it's fascinating. I love the idea that he pointed out, you know, that there are three or four or five ways that we really need to think about the fentanyl crisis and dealing with it. Even though he was kind of talking to presidential aspirants, it applies to everybody who is concerned about the problem and thinking of solutions. So that's the first article. Second article comes from the National Endowment for Democracy. Okay. And it was written by Will Freeman, who is a fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And its title is, Can Mexico's Next President Control the Military? And I read this not necessarily understanding what I was going to be reading, but was absolutely enthralled with the relationship between the Mexican government in general and the Mexican military, and how that might play out in this battle against the cartels, the efforts to cooperate between the United States and Mexico. So I want to share some of this with you, because again, I thought it was absolutely fascinating. So Mr. Freeman starts out, he says, on June 2nd, Mexico will hold the biggest election in its history. Voters will choose a new president, 628 members of Congress, and thousands of state and local officials. But there is at least one set of politically consequential decision makers that will not appear on the ballot: Mexico's armed forces. Since taking office in 2018, AMLO has assigned the military sweeping new powers, an even larger budget, and new revenue streams. He has also stood by as generals and officers have sought to insulate themselves from judicial investigations. It's no exaggeration to say the armed forces now have sway over security policy, tax collection, and the day-to-day operation of critical parts of the state. Despite that, he says, for now, Mexico remains a democracy despite its flaws. It's far from a tutelary regime in which generals call the shots and civilians only pretend to rule. While generals have successfully lobbied lawmakers to pass legislation and seem to have influenced AMLO's decision-making, there are no cut-and-dry cases of military leaders defying civilian orders. But the military has become as important to governments as any of the country's civilian bureaucracies. And in some policy areas, such as domestic security, perhaps even more so. The armed forces have taken charge of police work nationwide, the operation of Mexico's ports and customs offices, and the construction of key infrastructure. Mexico's next president, whether she's AMLO's protege, Claudia Sheinbaum, who leads in the polls, or opposition candidate, Xochitl Galvez, will find it difficult to govern without the armed forces' active support. Mexico's new normal, a civilian government that is chronically dependent on the military, does not threaten democracy in the familiar ways. There is no risk of a military coup in Mexico. Rather, it creates a new set of dilemmas for democracy regarding the collection and use of intelligence, the independence of the judiciary, and the provision of public goods. Military dependency and its associated dilemmas will likely be AMLO's most enduring legacy, not the social justice-inspired fourth transformation he promised. So if you start thinking about just that, and how that can affect domestic relations, foreign relations, dealing with the cartels, etc., you can see why this article got my interest. Mr. Freeman goes through some of the history of the dealings with the military in Mexico, and then he gets to AMLO's time period. He says, although civilian officials were relying on the military for public security before AMLO became president in 2018, he has done the most to entrench military dependency and extend it to new areas of government beyond public security. This is an about-face. Before assuming the presidency, López Obrador had vocally opposed the militarization of public security. Once he took office, however, he began calling the armed forces, incorruptible, and expanded the military's power like no president before him. AMLO dissolved the Federal Police Force and created the National Guard to replace it in 2019. The new force, at first formally under the control of a civilian ministry, received 80% of its personnel, much of its leadership, and extensive training from the military. In 2022, AMLO rallied his Moreno Party's lawmakers to place the National Guard under the Army's control through 2028. In 2023, the Supreme Court ruled the move unconstitutional and ordered a return to civilian control. AMLO has yet to implement that decision and recently pushed back with proposed legislation that would shore up the Army's control and expand the National Guard's role in investigating crime. But it goes further than that. AMLO has also used presidential decrees to put the Navy in charge of seaports and customs offices and dispatch the Army to build and operate multi-billion dollar infrastructure projects. He has put the armed forces in charge of constructing hundreds of new branches of a state-owned bank that distribute cash transfers to older adults. Add to that the airline, airport, and luxury hotels, which have rounded out the military's budding investment portfolio. I got to be honest, I was not aware of most of this. So this is just amazing to me. Mr. Freeman goes on to say that upon taking office and after firing tens of thousands of civilian bureaucrats in the name of austerity, AMLO came to see the armed forces as a cost-effective, disciplined, and above all, loyal substitute. There are some concerns when you have a military in this role. Mr. Freeman says, one risk of Mexico's military dependence comes with the armed forces' control of intelligence gathering, which raises the possibility of military leadership shaping rather than merely informing civilian decision-making. And he talks about some other areas in South America that have fallen prey to this issue. A second risk of military dependency is that it empowers the armed forces to block the investigation and prosecution of illegal behavior. And he talks specifically about the 2019 U.S. arrest of General Salvador Cienfuegos and the results from that. He then goes on to say, to talk about the interrelationship between the judiciary and the military. And he says specifically, I asked Supreme Court Judge Jose Ramon Cosio whether, in light of this case, and he's talking about the Cienfuegos case, he believes the judiciary is capable of investigating and holding accountable armed forces personnel who break the law. As things are now, he responded, the justice system cannot sanction the military. Lastly, Mr. Freeman says military dependency imperils democracy in a third way. It threatens to unleash a vicious cycle. The government tasks the military with providing public goods, sidelining the civilian institutions typically in charge. Soon, regardless of the quality of goods the military is delivering, whether infrastructure, security, or port management, a return to the old system becomes impossible as elected office holders find the old civilian institutions have withered away. Mexico is already caught in the spiral of this institutional decay. He also notes the irony, even though it's probably not technically ironic, so I'll use irony in the Alanis Morissette vernacular. He says Mexico City, with its competent civilian police force, is relatively safe. But across much of the rest of the country, where the National Guard patrols Mexico's militarized model of policing now coexists with rampant insecurity. In conclusion, he says, military dependence is sure to outlive AMLO's presidency. The generals he empowered, if they so wished, could hobble the next government simply by slowing or stopping work. Mexico's top presidential contenders take different positions on the military's new and expanding powers. Sheinbaum has defended AMLO's empowerment of the armed forces while also promising to strengthen state police forces. Galvez has pledged to gradually extricate the military from public security ports and infrastructure projects while rebuilding the federal police. But whomever wins in June could find herself facing the same dilemma. Top military brass reluctant to cede ground regardless of the president's personal preferences. And then I'll note, this is also something that the United States needs to be aware of for a variety of reasons, most of which I think are obvious, but one that may not be. Mr. Freeman says one fifth of Mexican army troops are currently deployed to police Mexico's borders and manage irregular migration, making them indispensable to this U.S. administration and the next. To exit military dependency, Mexico's next government would need to rebuild civilian police and bureaucracies, but that would require raising taxes. Currently, the country's tax revenue is the fifth lowest as a share of GDP in the region. But, he says, not even AMLO, with his considerable popularity, chose to spend his political capital attempting a tax hike. So, let's look at this in relation to what we've talked about. You know, so I talked about demand in the United States for fentanyl and other drugs. We talked about Mexican economics. Mr. Brown focused on things the United States might be able to do, including but not limited to the idea of holding Mexico and others accountable for the spread of fentanyl, for allowing precursors into Mexico. But what this article from Will Freeman talks about is there's a secondary player or another player in Mexico that must be considered if you're going to formulate a policy that could ever be effective against Mexico or effectively implemented with Mexico. Right? So in other words, what this seems to suggest, and it sure makes sense to me, is AMLO or his successor could sit down with President Biden or his successor and work out an agreement. But unless the military accepts that agreement, it's unlikely to ever get fully implemented. And because of the unique nature of the military, it's harder to do what Mr. Brown says need to be done, which is to hold them accountable. Are you going to hold AMLO accountable? Are you going to hold economic development accountable? How do you hold the military accountable? What this all says to me is that this is a very, very complex issue that doesn't have a simple answer. It does not have a politically expedient answer. And it doesn't have an answer that starts with rhetoric on both sides of the aisle that makes useful dialogue, productive dialogue, impossible. So in my mind, if we as an electorate and others in powers of influence want to effectuate policy that actually does something, that is effective, that doesn't just have... Have you noticed every damn bill in Congress seems to have a fancy name to it, you know? Forget the fancy names. Is it going to solve any of the problems? And if we continue to have this bifurcated system where, you know, a win by the other side is a tragic loss, everything is a zero-sum game, we're never going to get very far. And we're also not going to get very far if all we do is focus on surface issues and surface platitudes that do nothing to really address the problem long term. Okay, that was me on my soapbox. Again, you can find these articles online. Defense Opinion is where the Michael Brown article came from, National Endowment for Democracy, the Will Freeman article. I really found both of those interesting. I hope you enjoyed some of this. Irrespective of my rants, I just think the scope of the problem, the depth of the problem, the depth of analysis that's required is getting an intellectual sense is absolutely fascinating. In a real world sense is absolutely frightening. Next week, we've got a couple things on the table, so I'm not exactly sure where we're going to go. But we'll have something new and interesting. I'm going to keep focusing at least some time on the elections. You know, we have the election in Mexico in June. We have the U.S. election in November. The way is in which those affect or might affect the cartel, the cartels, the fight against the cartels, the fight against fentanyl. We'll continue to investigate. Again, both of these articles were in my newsletter last week. And after I put them in, I started thinking that it made for a good podcast. Hit me up if you want the pod or the newsletter. It comes out every week. I think you'd enjoy it. And thank you to everybody who has in the last couple of days sent a couple messages that encouraged me to keep doing what I'm doing. Every so often, those things mean more than you can imagine. So thank you to everybody. And that, my friends, is Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena for this week. And we will see you next Friday. Have a good week, everyone.